Good morning, everyone, and welcome. Welcome to those gathered in the pews, and welcome to those joining us via the web camera, wherever you are in the world. And welcome to anyone who happens to listen in at a later date. And congratulations to you all for remembering to change your clock last night. We begin with our opening words. Look to this day, for it is life. The very life of life. In its brief course lie all the verities and realities of our existence, the bliss of growth, the glory of achievement, the splendor of beauty. For yesterday is but a dream, and tomorrow is only a vision. But today, well lived, makes every yesterday a dream of happiness, and every tomorrow a vision of hope. Look well, therefore, to this day. Our chalice lighting words. We light our chalice to honor our world and to remind ourselves to treat the earth with care. It was not given to us by our parents. It was loaned to us by our children. We do not inherit the earth from our ancestors. We borrow it from our children. Now can we have our first hymn this morning, and it's hymn number 12, and it's O Life That Maketh All Things New. Hymn number 12. Let us pray. The prayers I've chosen this morning are from the Native American tradition, and this is a three-step prayer. First step, plant your feet firmly on the earth and use your five senses to give thanks to God for the countless ways God comes to us through his creation. For all the beauty that your eyes see, for all the sounds that your ears hear, for all the scents that you smell, for the taste you taste, for all that you feel, the sun, the wind, the snow, warmth or cold. Pray that this day you may be open and attuned to the countless ways God comes to us through your senses, through the gifts of creation. Step two, let go of all the pain, the struggle, the regret and failures, the garbage of yesterday. Step out of it, leave it behind, brush the dust of it from your feet. Step three, with this final step, step into the gift of a new day, full of hope, promise, and potential. Give thanks for the gift of this new day, which God has made. Now can we say together words that attempt to articulate the aims of our community, and they're in the back of the hymn book on the back inner page. Love is the doctrine of this church. The quest of truth is its sacrament, and service is its prayer. To dwell together in peace, to seek knowledge and freedom, to serve humankind in fellowship, to the end that all souls shall grow in harmony with the divine, this do we covenant with each other and with God. Our reader this morning is Aidan.
Good morning to you all. I have decided to put my head above the parapet and engage in the culture wars. Those swirling waters of identity politics, wokeism, and a cancellation ethos. Many are of the view that the debate and argument in this arena are becoming increasingly antagonistic, angry, and even intolerant. And tolerance, it must be remembered, is one of the foundation pillars of Unitarianism. I am going to read part of an opinion piece that appeared in January in the Irish Times about cancellation culture. But first, some background. George Berkeley, the 18th century Anglican bishop, is Ireland's most celebrated philosopher. He has both a prestigious university and a city in the United States named after him. Domestically, he is synonymous with Trinity College, Dublin, where his name is lent to a college library. The Berkeley Library was completed in the mid-1960s and is regarded as a masterpiece of brutalist architecture. However, now, Trinity College Dublin's Review Legacies Working Group is considering whether his name should be removed from this library. Why? Well, George Berkeley was guilty of racial prejudice and slave owning. He once described the Irish poor as a lazy, destitute race, and he bought a small slave plantation on Rhode Island. Since we all deplore both racism and slavery, shouldn't we disown him? In the words of Dr. Claire Moriarty, a distinguished scholar of both philosophy and mathematics, Berkeley was, I quote, unquestionably a great metaphysical thinker and a brilliant writer. But he was also extremely morally fallible. End of quote. He seems to have had some serious moral flaws, like much of humankind. So do we cancel and delist him? The opinion piece from which I will read is written by Nigel Bigger, who is a retired professor of moral theology at the University of Oxford and a former professor of theology at Trinity College, Dublin. It is entitled, "Erasing Berkeley's Name from Trinity Would Do Nothing to Combat Racial Prejudice in Ireland." I should point out that I fully agree with the sentiments expressed in the article, but I also acknowledge that others could be of a different opinion, and I would like to think that I would listen respectfully to their views. In the early part of the piece, Nigel Bigger points out how widespread the practice of slavery and slave owning had been historically in the Greek, Roman, early European and Arab worlds. He continues. British and Irish slave trading and slavery from 1650 was nothing out of the ordinary. What was extraordinary was that from 1770, two decades after George Berkeley's death, an anti-slavery movement began to grow in Britain. The result was, through their united parliaments, the British and Irish were among the first peoples in the world, in the history of the world, to repudiate the slave trade and slavery in 1807 and 1833, respectively. And they were the leading people to devote themselves to the global suppression of slavery throughout the British Empire in the following century and a half. It follows that there is no direct causal line between the ugly racism that justified 18th century slavery and whatever racism persists among us today. Because the highly popular abolition movement, with its humanitarian successors, were propelled by the Christian conviction that members of all races are equal in the sight of God. Consequently, according to the historian of abolition, John Stopher, almost every United States black who traveled in the British Isles acknowledged the comparative absence of racism there. The famous black American abolitionist Frederick Douglass noted after arriving in England in 1845, "I saw in every man a recognition of my manhood and an absence, a perfect absence, of everything that disgusting hate with which we were pursued in the United States." Therefore, to erase Berkeley's name from TCD would do nothing to combat racial prejudice in Ireland today. Since he has never been venerated for his racist views of the Irish poor and slave ownership, to repudiate him would not be to repudiate them. In celebrating people, we admire them only for some things that they have done. We admire Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King as heroic examples of non-violent resistance, despite respectively their disparaging views of Africans and serial marital infidelity. So we should continue to celebrate George Berkeley as the outstanding philosopher he was. And when provoked by his name to reflect on his prejudice and obtuseness, we should lament them. But then we should spare some critical attention to our own moral flaws. That would make a difference.
Now, we always have our children's story, but today I am, rather than telling a once upon a time story, I'm going to read a tongue-in-cheek prayer from the Pueblo Indians, thanking the white man for all the gifts he brought. It says, "Before our white brothers arrived to make us civilized men, we didn't have any kind of prisons. So because of this, we had no delinquents. Without a prison, there can be no delinquents. We had no locks nor keys, and therefore among us there were no thieves. And when someone was so poor they couldn't afford a tent or a blanket, he would in that case receive it as a gift. We were too uncivilized to give great importance to private property. We didn't know any kind of money, and consequently, we didn't value human beings by how wealthy they were. We had no written laws laid down, no lawyers, no politicians. Therefore, we were not able to cheat and swindle one another. We were really in bad shape before the white man arrived, and I don't know how to explain how we were able to manage without these things that are so fundamental and necessary for a civilized society. Very tongue-in-cheek. Now we're going to have our second hymn this morning, and it's hymn number 53, I Walk the Unfrequented Road. Hymn number 53. From my reading, I have chosen a piece. It was written by Chief Seattle. Sorry, it wasn't written by him. He made the speech and it was taken down from him and widely circulated at the time. And Chief Seattle died in 1866. The great chief in Washington sends word that he wishes to buy our land. The great chief also sends us word of friendship and goodwill. How can you buy or sell the sky, the warmth of the land? That idea is strange to us. Every part of the earth is sacred to my people. The white man's dead forget the country of their birth when they go to walk among the stars. Our dead never forget this beautiful earth, for it is our mother. We are part of the earth, and it is part of us. The perfumed flowers are our sisters, the deer, the horse, the great eagle. These are our brothers. The rocky crests, the juices in the meadow, the body of the pony and the man, they all belong to the same family. To the great white chief, one portion of land is the same as the next, for he is a stranger who comes in the night, takes from the land whatever he needs. The earth is not his brother, but his enemy. And when he has conquered it, he moves on. He kidnaps the earth from his children. He does not care. His father's graves and his children's birthright are forgotten. He treats his mother, the earth, and his brother, the sky, as things to be bought, plundered, sold like sheep or bright beads, his appetites to devour the earth, leave behind only a desert. There's no quiet place in men's cities, no place to hear the unfurling of leaves in spring or the rustle of insects' wings. But perhaps it is because I am a savage and do not understand. The Indian prefers the soft sound of the wind darting over the face of the pond and the smell of the wind itself, cleansed by a midday rain or scented with pine. So we will consider your offer to buy our land. If we decide to accept, I will make one condition. The white man must treat the beasts of this land as his brothers. What is earth without the beasts? All the beasts, when they're gone, man will die from loneliness of spirit. For whatever happens to the beasts soon will happen to men. All things are connected. The earth does not belong to man. Man belongs to the earth. Men did not weave the web of life. He is merely a strand in it. Whatever he does to the web, he does to himself. Before we consider our offer to go to live in the reservation you have for my people, we will live apart and at peace. It matters little where we spend the end of our days. Our children have seen their fathers humbled in defeat. Our warriors have felt shame after defeat, and they spend their days in idleness and contaminate their bodies with sweet food and strong drinks. It matters little where we pass the rest of our days. One thing we know, which the white man may one day discover, our God and yours is the same. You may think now that you own him as you wish to own our land, but you cannot. He is the God of man, and his compassion is equal for the red man and the white. The earth is precious to him, and to harm the earth is to heap contempt on its creator. The whites too will pass away, perhaps sooner than all their tribes. If they continue to contaminate your bread, you will one day suffocate in your own waste. Written sometime prior to 1866. Let us pray. Great Spirit, whose voice I hear in the winds, and whose breath gives life to all the world, hear me. I need your strength and your wisdom. Let me walk in beauty and make my eyes ever behold the purple sunset. Make my hands respect the things you have made, and my ears sharp to hear your voice. Make me wise that I may understand the things that you have taught my people. Let me learn the lessons you have hidden in every leaf and rock. Help me remain calm and strong in the face of all that comes towards me. Help me to find compassion without empathy overwhelming me. I seek strength not to be greater than my brother, but to fight my greatest enemy, myself. Make me always ready to come to you with clean hands and straight eyes. So when life fades, as the fading sunset, my spirit may come to you without shame. You now have a time for silent contemplation, which will be brought to an end by music. The title of this morning's address is Entitlement, and every so often I remind the congregation that these are my thoughts. No one has to believe me. It's easily forgotten that Jesus did not establish a new religion. Jesus was born Jewish, he died Jewish. What he did do was bring new thinking to his Jewish faith. Paul, the disciple, was also of the Jewish faith. However, Paul was born a Jew outside of the land of Israel. At that time, the dominant culture of the Mediterranean was Greek. The international language of the time was Greek. The great philosophical schools of Socrates and Plato were Greek. It was the birthplace of democracy. The art of theatre began in Greece. Paul was part and born into that cosmopolitan Greek world. And Paul also belonged to a privileged elite because he was also a Roman citizen. And it is likely that Paul was born rich. Now, he doesn't say that. It is surmised from the fact that Paul repeats over and over again, I don't sponge off anyone, I work to earn a living. And people who have always had to work don't tell everyone they meet that they have a job, that they work for a living. It is just assumed we all work for a living. Paul introduced the message of Jesus outside of the world beyond Judaism. And naturally, his teachings were mediated through his background and experiences. So Paul brought the God of the Jews to a very cosmopolitan world. And in quite a short period of time, Christianity became the official religion of the Roman Empire. Jesus was declared God incarnate. Christianity was part of the most powerful empire the world had ever seen. So not only was the Roman Empire powerful, so too was its God, that was now Jesus. The story of Jesus, born in a stable in poverty, moved into the halls of power at a very early time in its development. And when the Roman Empire collapsed, the Christian faith by then was established in political power systems. 40 years after the death of Jesus, the Jewish nation was dispersed from the land of Israel. Within a short period of time, Jews and Christians were then separate faiths. And Christians blamed Jews for the death of Jesus, and this accusation was used as a reason to persecute the dispossessed Jews. The Jews were wandering in Europe, they were homeless, they were refugees, and Christians could have said, well, they're the ones who killed Jesus. You know, we all look for an excuse to dislike strangers. Images of Jesus in the Christian story come to us through the prism of Western eyes. Just for a moment, think of how the Nazis and their propaganda portrayed Jewish citizens of Germany. They were shown as swarthy in appearance, dirty, uncouth, awkward looking. That's not how Jesus is ever portrayed. He is portrayed as strong and handsome, and his mother generally has fair hair and blue eyes. I wonder if it was this historic association with empire that has given Western culture and religion this sense of entitlement that we Westerners have. European colonization spread Christianity throughout the world. Christians speak of bringing the good news of Christianity, but almost without exception, the arrival of Christians was disastrous for indigenous peoples. Jesus said that in God's kingdom, the poor, the dispossessed, and the simple would have premier place. St. Paul thought that in Christianity there is equality. He wrote, there is neither Jew nor Gentile, men or women, slave or free. There may have been equality between Christians when they gathered together to share bread and wine, but that equality rarely spread beyond the communion table. The certainties of Christians that theirs was the only correct truth facilitated them in destroying indigenous cultures. Now, we in Ireland have never owned an empire, personally. Irish as a nation haven't. But we were an active participation in the affairs of the British Empire, of which we are a part. And from the 19th century onward, Ireland sent countless missionaries to less developed countries. And that was probably done with good intention, but it came with a sense of paternalistic superiority. We knew better than the people we were going to. The message of Western cultural superiority is pervasive. When Western culture discovered the Americas, they brought with them diseases. They were lethal to the local populations. The Spaniards and the Portuguese went to South America, and by the 19th century, having changed South America, got rid of the Aztec religion and the Mayan religion, with a mixture of coercion and persuasion, they were the richest landowners in Spanish-speaking America by the 19th century. They owned every third-level education college, and they owned every power source in every village. In North America, it was government policy to destroy Indian culture. When gold was discovered on Indian ancestral lands, the Indians were forcibly removed west of the Mississippi in what is now called the Trail of Tears. Having taken possession of the land, the settlers had stolen from the Native Americans. They then stole people from Africa to farm that land. And they used selective parts of the Bible to condone slavery. In the Jewish Bible, the children of slaves were not slaves. They were free. It wasn't handed on like an inheritance. Slavery was often for a particular period of time because of a debt or something like that. And regularly, slaves were freed. That was just part of the land of slavery in the Jewish Bible. But that was never part of American slavery. In Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and Africa, the story is similar, with the additional torture that children were forcibly removed from parents and family. All done in the name of him who loved little children, because we knew better than anyone else. It was only as an adult that I began to appreciate how pervasive the Western sense of entitled privilege is. As a child, I remember my brothers pressurizing me to play cowboys and Indians. And I didn't want to play because I would have to be the Indian. And I knew the Indians were the bad guys, they were the savages, and the Indians never won. The cowboys always won, and I wanted to be a cowboy. And no, I had to be the Indian, so I didn't want to play. Another memory I have is of hearing an African-American woman say in some interview that she felt blessed that she was born a woman of color, because she said white people were very self-seeking. And I remember thinking, why would anyone want to be born colored? Because I knew nothing about segregation laws, knew nothing about that. But I did know instinctively that people of color were somehow second-class citizens, second-class humans, really. I never got a lesson about that. My parents never spoke to me about anything like that. No teacher ever said that, but I knew it. And where did I learn it? I learned it from television and from books, from comic strips, from cowboy films. But surely we say that that is all in the past, especially in the case of us well-educated people. But superiority complex, it should be long gone. But unfortunately, I think the Western mindset is still firmly set in entitlement mode. Why else is there a need for protests about Black Lives Matter? Why are the figure for hate crimes in Ireland rising? Our sense of entitlement is highlighted in our attitude to third world populations when it comes to global warming and climate chaos. In early centuries, the certainty of belief about Christianity may have bolstered our sense of superior entitlement. But we can't blame religion for it now, because no one or very few people are going to churches. The reality is that we still think that we are entitled to more than others. It's several years since I read that piece by Chief Seattle. He died in 1866, but how prophetic are his words. More than 140 years ago, the Native American Indian knew the truth that what men do to beasts and to the earth, we do to ourselves. The Americans made a promise to the Indians that they would look after the beasts. We are losing species at an unprecedented and accelerating rate. We write reports, we hold conferences, we talk about what we must do. We want anyone except ourselves to change our behavior to halt this decline in biodiversity. We want everyone to take action to reduce carbon emissions. Everyone else. But they are not doing it. Why should we do it? We only do this. We still think that we are entitled to our accustomed comfort. We have no conscience that the poorest countries who contribute least amount to carbon towards global warming are suffering the effects of climate chaos. We talk about climate justice, but is our sense of justice really offended? Do we feel it, or do we just think of it in a technical sort of way? Another boatload of refugees sank in the Mediterranean last night. Do we lose any sleep over that? If we really felt that there was injustice, we would badger our government to pass laws. And more importantly, we would do something about it. Cut down on our driving. Use less electricity. Moderate the things we want. I mentioned earlier of how I learned wrongly from films and comics that native cultures are inferior to Western culture. I learned that we were superior to other peoples. And while writing this, I realized that there's something else I think I may have taken from the stories that is also something completely wrong. And this is an even bigger mistake on my part, and this only came to me the other day. I was wrong when I thought about Indians and native peoples as being inferior to us. Here's what else I discovered. In those comic strips and in the films, no matter how dire the situation seemed to be for the good guys, the invaders, rescue always came. Just when the fort is certain to fall into Indian hands, when they're down to their last two rounds of ammunition, either the token good Indian or Rin Tin Tin the dog would manage to slip through the cordon, and just in the nick of the time, the cavalry came charging over the hill and we went home happy. They were rescued. Rescue came late, but rescue always came. Could it be that we're still waiting for the cavalry to save us from our folly? I hope, please someone tell me, there's some good Indian out there, or at least a very clever dog who's going to save the day for us. Amen. We're going to have our third hymn now, and that is hymn number 76, For Flowers That Bloom About Our Feet. And as we sing it, we will have our offertory. Our notices, fair trade tea and coffee are served downstairs in the Damer Hall. There are also cakes for sale and lots of books to browse through. So enjoy your cuppa, a cake and browse for books. The money that we raise for this is going to help fund replacing our lighting system with a more eco-friendly lighting system. Wednesday lunchtime, there's a service of reflection available in church and online between 1:05 and 1:35. Next Sunday, the 2nd of April, immediately after the service, there's a launch of a new book here. It's by a writer called Peter Keenan, and it's about the death of Jesus the Jew. And everyone is welcome to stay back for that book launch. Good Friday is the 7th of April, and we will have our annual readings of the names of everyone killed in 30 years of violence in Northern Ireland. I need about 18 volunteers. We start at 12 o'clock, we finish at about 3:15, and we need people to come in, just read the names, and that's it. The AGM of the congregation will take place on Sunday, the 23rd of April. There is a tin on the table for Christian Aid. It's been our tradition for some years to have that there during Lent. The money goes to Christian Aid. And in May, we are going to have a plant sale, and I am busy transplanting seedlings. Butter boxes, your butter tubs, marge tubs, anything like that, that I can reuse to plant things up, is eco-friendly and great, and we will have cheap plants as well. Our final hymn this morning is hymn number 129. Let Love Continue Long. Hymn number 129. Our blessing. God, maker of the universe, creator of nature, God within each one of us, may all I say, all I do, and all I think be in harmony with you. Amen.